Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Fullilove. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. And I'm delighted to welcome you to this discussion with Troy Bramston, the author of this terrific new book, Robert Menzies, The Art of Politics, which will be on sale for $45 for a signed copy at the end of the session. Everybody here, I'm sure, knows Troy by reputation. I'm sure you read him in the Oz every day. He's a columnist and a reporter, and unusually for a reporter of his generation and a columnist of his generation, someone who's very knowledgeable about history and puts the time in to understand political history, which sometimes we miss, I'm afraid, these days. He's also a prolific author. I think this is his ninth book, is that right?
Yes.
Authored or edited book. He's written books on the dismissal, on Paul Keating, on the Rudd-Gillard governments. Essentially, he is creating his own library of Australian political history. And for this book, he's taken as his subject Robert Menzies, who was a dominant figure in Australian life in the 20th century. It's hard to overstate the influence that Menzies had on our country. And, of course, Menzies is a great subject for a book because of the length of his career and also his nice turn of phrase. I always find it's more fun to write about someone who is witty. I always remember that line when the heckler once yelled to Menzies, I wouldn't vote for you even if you were the Archangel Gabriel. And Menzies replied, "Sir, if I were the Archangel Gabriel, you wouldn't be in my constituency." So today we're going to discuss Menzies, Troy's book, and in particular, given that this is the Lowy Institute, the international dimensions of Menzies' career. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me belatedly in welcoming Troy Bramston. So, Troy, first of all, why did you write this book on Menzies, apart from the fact that you've gone through many of the other prime ministers of the century? Why Menzies? Why are you interested in him?
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you all for coming. It's great to be here at the Lowy Institute, having visited here and seen so many speakers over the years. It's a privilege to be able to speak to you all. Look, why do a book on Menzies? Well, funny enough, you know, he's our longest-serving prime minister, the only prime minister to leave office at a time of their own choosing in the past 50 years. Yet it's been 20 years since anyone has written a biography of Menzies, a full life biography. And this always sort of perplexed me. And I started to do some research into the Liberal Party's archives a few years ago and looking also at Menzies' archives because, you know, he has something like 650 boxes of papers at the National Library. And a lot of historians haven't bothered to really look at these in great detail. And I was amazed at some of the things that I found, which I've been able to disclose in the book. But also I learnt the story that Menzies had an official biographer by the name of Frances McNichol, and she had access to the Menzies papers for 20 years after he had retired from the prime ministership. She interviewed him at length in the early 1970s, but the book never appeared. The project simply overwhelmed her. Menzies is a very daunting subject for everybody, even today. So I was able to get access to these interviews, and they really cast a new light on Menzies. Here he is in the twilight of his life, reflecting on everything from his growing up in country Japaret to his time as Prime Minister and as a minister in state politics, and, you know, his reflections on Australia and the world in the 1970s. So it was a remarkable opportunity, and I thought these should be used in a new book. The other point to make briefly is that, you know, interpreting Menzies is core business for every Liberal Party leader these days. He looms large as a figure over the party, and every leader wants to enlist him to their cause. But, of course, who Menzies was and what he represented is contested in the party that he founded and led. So if you're Malcolm Fraser, Menzies was a Liberal. If you're Tony Abbott and John Howard, Menzies was a Conservative. If you're Malcolm Turnbull, he's a centrist. And then, of course, that leaves us with Scott Morrison, who famously said, "Whatever Menzies believed in then is what we believe in now." So whatever that means, I don't know. But the point is they all identify with Menzies.
Didn't Morrison also say how good is Menzies?
He did. I think he says that every morning when he looks in the mirror and has a shave.
All right, so that's why Menzies. Now, some of the interesting revelations in the book relate to Menzies' experience, his formative experiences in World War I, and then, of course, his famous sojourn to London in World War II. And when I was writing my book on World War II, one of the things I loved doing was looking at Menzies' old colour videos that he recorded. Menzies was a great photographer and videographer. He had a little camera and recorded some terrific footage from London and surrounds in the 1940s. But tell us a bit about Menzies and the First World War, because of course his the allegation that he of cowardice hung around Menzies for a long time, and how that affected his second World War experience.
Yeah, of course, Menzies was born in 1894 in Japarit. He's the last prime minister born in the 19th century. Very humble beginning, and he found his way to Melbourne University after winning scholarship after scholarship and the family relocating there. And World War I was, I think, the defining influence in Menzies' life. As a biographer, you always look for the sort of key moments, the turning points, and World War I is the moment for Menzies, and previous biographers, I think, have overlooked this critical factor, largely because he never really talked about it before. But what had happened was, Menzies had two older brothers, Les and Frank Menzies, and they enlisted in the First World War and they were sent abroad. James and Kate Menzies, his parents, had a daughter by the name of Belle. She had eloped during the war with a soldier by the name of George Green. And so the family was in emotional turmoil. Two sons abroad, a daughter had eloped. The daughter was told by James Menzies to never darken his doorstep again. She was banished from the family. So the family's in emotional turmoil, and young Robert Menzies is studying law at the University of Melbourne, and the family decides he should stay at home to look after them. Now, this is not an uncommon thing for many, many thousands of Australian families during the First World War, but it led to Menzies being branded a coward, someone without courage, for the rest of his political life. And in these interviews that he gave with Francis McNicoll, which hadn't been published before, he says this was the reason, not a reason, but the reason he went into politics, was to serve his country in another way, to try to erase the stain that had been on his name. And so that's why we see Menzies go into state politics, but these attacks keep coming. And when he's in federal politics, one of the most famous attacks was from Eddie Ward, who recalled that Menzies had been part of the Army Reserve Scheme at the University of Melbourne, and Eddie Ward would often shout out, "Robert Menzies had a great military career cut short by war." And so this is a phrase often repeated. And one day I decided to ring up Bill Hayden, who went into Parliament in 1961, and I asked him about this. And I get to talk to Bill from time to time, and he told me the story that he had actually used this phrase as well. But a number of the other older Labor MPs set him straight about the family's circumstances, and Menzies would often be attacked on public platforms for not serving. And so then in the Second World War, when he's Prime Minister for the first time, he says in these interviews that one of the reasons he decides to go abroad for 4 months at the beginning of 1941, he goes to Washington, London, Dublin, Ottawa, is partly to show Australians that he was not without courage, that he could be there in London during the Blitz as the bombs are falling. He could talk to Churchill in the British War Cabinet. He wanted to be in the action. He wanted to visit the Australian troops in the Middle East. And so what we see here is Menzies chasing his demons. And he's chasing these demons even right through to his 40s and 50s, if not the rest of his life.
He wasn't just chasing his demons, though, when he took that four-month trip. He was also chasing his ambitions, wasn't he, in the sense that he liked to be sitting at the big table. He would say that he thought Australia's interests were furthered if he could join the War Cabinet from time to time for some of their discussions, if he could be at Chequers or Downing Street and meet with these leaders. Now, one of the things that is sometimes said about Menzies is that he wasn't a proud Australian, and in fact, perhaps, or at least that his Australianness was sort of subservient to his greater Britishness, if you like. And some people say that he had ambitions of taking over the Prime Ministership of Great Britain should if Churchill had fallen in one of those difficult periods. So what did, when you looked at the papers, what conclusion did you reach on that point?
Menzies certainly loved being in London. He went to London four times in the mid-1930s. He loved being there. He loved the British legal tradition. He loved Westminster-style democracy. He loved the monarchy. He loved the theatres, the bars, the establishment. He loved being in London. So when he had an opportunity to go there, he decided to take it and to seize it. And, of course, he wanted to be in the British War Cabinet, but he didn't really like Churchill that much in terms of what he saw. He thought Churchill's cabinet were full of yes men, was the words he used. He thought Churchill was a bit of a dictator. He wouldn't listen to other people's advice. And, of course, the experience of the Australian troops in Greece and Crete had gone very badly, and Menzies had been misled. He also tried to convince Churchill to reinforce Singapore, but Churchill didn't want to do that. So as Menzies is in London, Churchill is utterly dominant, though, although not without his critics. And Menzies was seen as a very young, ambitious, urbane, professional guy from Australia. And Menzies' daughter, Heather Henderson, who's 90 years old and who I interviewed, she told me that often, she'd heard from her mother that a lot of people in London would say to him, oh, you should join the House of Commons, you should get into British politics. But the claim made by David Day that Menzies actively sought to position himself to replace Churchill as Prime Minister, I don't think can be sustained. I think it's too much of a leap. And the other thing to say about Menzies is I honestly think, having read all of his statements and interviewed his former staff and ministers that are still around, while he loved Britain, his heart was with Australia. He was an Australian. But a lot of Australians in that era, including John Curtin and Ben Chifley, still saw themselves as partly British and part of the British Empire. So they had that kind of dual national identity. But I think it's too much of a leap to think that Menzies thought that he could replace Churchill. Mm.
I think that's an important point to remember, that even Curtin, for example, I remember reading a speech that Curtin gave where he said that Australia would lay claim to the cricket pitch at Lord's, for example.
Yes.
I mean, they very much, even the Labor leaders, nowadays we sort of impose different view on leaders at the time, but I think both Labor and Conservative leaders at that time saw themselves as British in a general sense, but they didn't see that inconsistent with being Australian.
That's right.
Now, obviously, Mr. Menzies lost office, but the war was carried on by the Labor prime ministers of predominantly of Curtin, later of Chifley. But Menzies returned to office, and he had this very long dominant period in office. Now, one of the phrases that we associate with Menzies' period as prime minister is that of the great and powerful friends, and. Again, when we think about Menzies' foreign policy, we think about that emphasis on the Anglophone allies, predominantly the United States and Britain. Talk to us a bit about that, and explain to us, if you will, how did he balance those relationships with the great and powerful friends on the one hand, with regional relationships in Asia, and also with membership of the United Nations and sort of multilateralism. How did Menzies see great and powerful friends in relation to those other two dimensions?
Menzies, I think, in terms of his second prime ministership, was very strategic and very pragmatic. He didn't go in for grand schemes of foreign policy, so he wasn't a great admirer of the United Nations, and he did have a very strongly Anglophile outlook. And this phrase we hear all the time, great and powerful friends, is actually from Menzies. Menzies actually said that. That was how he identified his foreign policy. And what he was saying to Australia in the post-war years was that the way we guarantee our security here in the Southern Pacific is to have these great and powerful friends. And that means Great Britain, and that means the United States. And whilst he had that outlook and he loved being in the British Commonwealth the government meetings, back then they'd call it Prime Minister's conferences. He'd go to London every year. And as his prime ministership lengthened, he was regarded as, the senior Commonwealth statesman around the world. And he would go toe-to-toe with all the Commonwealth countries. He had a very strong view about non-interference. So when issues like apartheid would come up and divide the Commonwealth, Menzies was very much of the view about non-intervention. And apartheid was actually a good framework to sort of examine Menzies' approach to foreign policy. He did not support apartheid, but he didn't want to tell South Africa what it had to do. And this led to a number of clashes in the Commonwealth, including Canadian Prime Minister John Diefenbaker, Jawaharlal Nehru, the Indian Prime Minister, and others as well who wanted to take a different course. And in Menzies' own cabinet, you know, I do argue in the book, I think Menzies stayed too long as Prime Ministership and was increasingly out of time by the mid-1960s because his External Affairs Minister, Garfield Barwick, was one who was urging him to change his public position on apartheid, take diplomatic steps to get South Africa to change its policies and undergo some private talks. But Menzies wouldn't have a bar of it. But he very much focused on these personal relationships. That's how he viewed foreign policy. So, you know, someone once said that that Menzies didn't visit many countries in Asia, but he in fact went to most of them in Asia, and he went to a lot of the Pacific countries as well. But it was his relationships with British prime ministers and American presidents that were extremely warm. And although there were often disagreements, you know, he disagreed with Eisenhower on the Suez Crisis, he disagreed with Kennedy on such as, you know, whether the Dutch should maintain their position in West New Guinea or defending Malaysia against Indonesia during the confrontation. These American presidents had great warmth for Menzies, and they loved having him around. And even Lyndon Johnson would invite Menzies to the White House as an ex-prime minister for lunch or for dinner or even for breakfast. You can look at the LBJ records and see his diary. So, you know, he had this great warmth and this relationship with so many world leaders and also with the Queen, of course, and her father. And so he was admired and respected, but, you know, he wasn't actually very successful on the world stage. And a lot of the ideas he pursued, you know, he supported the Dutch in West New Guinea. As I said, he wanted the US to help defend Malaysia. He couldn't get that to happen. He advocated, of course, and prosecuted the Vietnam War. I think that was a huge mistake. And so he wasn't actually very successful in the way he inserted himself on the world stage, but he was admired and respected by leaders around the world.
Perhaps those two comments are flip sides of the same coin. I mean, he represented an older view of the world, and the world was changing, and colonialism was falling, and I guess he was slow to realise that in a way. You mentioned.
Can I just add there are two quick caveats to that. One is the trade treaty with Japan in 1957, you know, established Australia's most important post-war long-term trade relationship, very significant. And the Labor Party opposed the trade treaty with Japan in 1957. That was critical. So that was showing some foresight. There's the ANZUS Treaty, which of course he signed. He didn't sign it, but he negotiated it and supported it. And there's also the Colombo Plan, which was Percy Spender's great idea, essentially a Commonwealth aid type program, which also helped to educate Australian universities Asian students. So he's showing some initiative at the edges, particularly towards the end of his prime ministership, and he could feel the world changing. And just to finish with this comment, Michael, is that in these interviews, he says, "I am an old Commonwealth man."
The last Commonwealth man, yes.
And he still sees himself as very much tied to that Anglophile outlook. So even he knew that the world was changing and he didn't feel all that comfortable with it.
And how did that affect his... The fact that he saw himself as the last Commonwealth man, or recognised himself as being the last Commonwealth man, how did that affect his view of the alliance? Now, you and I were discussing earlier that the alliance is this interesting institution in Australian politics where both sides of politics not only support it but claim it. Labor says they invented the alliance in 1941 with Curtin's declaration that he looked to America, and the coalition claims it because of the 1951 ANZUS Treaty. How much credit for ANZUS should go to Menzies as opposed to Spender, do you think? And what did Menzies think about the US alliance? Was it coloured in a way by the fact that he also saw himself as the last Commonwealth man?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you ask Percy Spender, he would say Menzies had very little to do with the Anzus Treaty. And so Spender wrote a terrific book. I think it's published by Sydney University Press, not widely published or not many copies around, but he tells a story about how Anzus came about. And, of course, it was a formalisation of the relationship that had been forged with the Curtin government during the Second World War and so many US soldiers coming here. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, credit must go to Menzies' government for formally signing that treaty. But Spender says that Menzies didn't actually think Australia needed it. He thought that the US relationship was strong and secure, and if Australia was ever threatened, that the US would always come to Australia's aid, whether there was a treaty or not. So that's how Menzies sort of saw that. But over time, I think he saw it as being critical. I mean, it's now one of the pillars of Australian foreign policy. And towards the end of his life, he would claim it as one of his great achievements, even though Percy Spender said he didn't have much interest in it. The other side point to note is that Clement Attlee, of course, was the British Prime Minister when Anzus was signed, and he wanted the British to be in Anzus. But there was no support for that, particularly from the Americans. And there's a great story I recount in the book how Churchill had apparently bailed up Menzies in one of the corridors of Number 10 Downing Street one day and said, you know, listen, this Anzus business, we should be in these things. This should be us. We should be there. But, you know, Menzies tried to say to him, look, you know, this is really not for you. It's a more of a Pacific alliance. And the British influence in the Asia Pacific was declining rapidly.
Now, one of the other decisions that you mentioned briefly was Menzies' decision to take Australia into Vietnam initially. And we remember the speech that Menzies gave to the House of Representatives announcing that decision. And then, of course, we remember Corwell's brilliant response drafted by our mutual friend Graham Freudenberg, which is a terrific speech really setting out argument after argument, the principled opposition to Australia's involvement in Vietnam. One of the interesting things about that was I remember speaking to Freudenberg about that speech when I was doing a book of great speeches, and he said to me that although Menzies' speech on paper was not that impressive, he said Menzies was the supreme parliamentarian, and Menzies' speeches sometimes on paper don't read as well as they sounded. And he said, actually, to be in the House of Representatives and hear Menzies' interventions in those debates really gave you a sense of his strength as a parliamentary performer. In any case, if he has Anzus on one side of the balance sheet, then arguably he has Vietnam on the other side of the balance sheet. So did Menzies ever change his view on the rightness of the decision to go into Vietnam? And how would you judge Menzies' decision on Vietnam?
Look, I'm very tough on Menzies when it comes to Vietnam. Having looked back at the original decision-making process, the prosecution of the war, the alternative viewpoints at the time, I think that's where history comes down very harshly on Menzies, because essentially Australia invited itself to the Vietnam War. There's no doubt about that, that a sub-cabinet committee meeting in early 1965 had decided that it would offer troops to Vietnam, even though there'd been no formal announcement. But when Menzies makes the formal speech of announcement, I think it's in April or May 1965, he says this is in response to a request from the South Vietnamese government, and that was not true. There had been no formal request by the time the decision had been made. And the basis for which Australia went is very flawed. You know, there's an official history of Australia in the Vietnam War by Peter Edwards, a great historian. He's very harsh on Menzies as well for not fully understanding the strategic implications of this decision, the nature of the relationship with the United States. It was based on a blind faith in United States supremacy. There was no suggestion other than in Corwell's speech that the US would be defeated in Vietnam. That was unthinkable. So Corwell's speech is remembered for the accuracy of its prediction, which is that America would fail and have to withdraw with its tail between its legs. But Menzies says in his announcement speech that if North Vietnam overran the South, that Australia would be imperiled. That is, that Australia would be invaded. And that did happen, but not with the consequences that Menzies said. So the whole principal basis for him sending Australian troops there is based on a completely false premise. He also talked about the downward thrust of Chinese communism. Well, anyone who understands the Vietnam War, and this is a criticism of the Menzies cabinet for not fully understanding it, knows that it was more about nationalism than some kind of fight for worldwide communism. And of course, by 1979, just 4 years after the war, Vietnam was actually at war with China. So, you know, on all these arguments for Australia to go, other than the defeat and the terrible loss of life, 500 Australian men, it was a flawed decision and not one that was properly understood. I should say also that I'd met with and interviewed A.J. Forbes. He's the last Liberal minister living from the Menzies government, and he was 95 in December, and I interviewed him at his home in Adelaide. He was the Minister for the Army, and he says there was very little discussion in sub-cabinet committees or in cabinet about this decision. It was pretty much a tick-and-flick decision, and that reflects poorly on the Menzies cabinet as well. It shows you how dominant Menzies was, having made up his mind that there was very little discussion about these issues. And the other point I'd make about that, interestingly, is that I found an interview that Garfield Barwick had given. Now, Barwick was on the High Court by the time this decision had been made, but Barwick said he would not have supported sending troops to Vietnam because it meant if you send a combat forces, you must reintroduce national service. And that means replenishing soldiers with regular men. And that was another reason why he opposed it. He also thought that war would fail, and he was right about that. And the other interesting thing that Barwick says is that he talked about Vietnam with John F. Kennedy in 1961 or 1962, and he says he got the clear impression from Kennedy that he would not have sent combat troops to Vietnam.
All right, now I'm going to come to the audience in a second, give you an opportunity to ask Troy questions, but I want to fast forward to the present and ask about Scott Morrison and Robert Menzies. But in order to get there, I'm going to deviate just with one question, take the advantage of the fact that we have a columnist for the Oz here. Obviously, I want to ask you about Morrison's foreign policy, but the only reason Mr. Morrison's going to have an opportunity to implement a foreign policy is he was re-elected. And it was a great surprise to many experts, although it's one of those interesting decisions that no one predicted, but in retrospect, everybody apparently knew. Or at least in retrospect, the reasons for the result seem clear. But now that you've had a week or two to reflect on it, how would you summarise why Mr. Morrison's government was re-elected despite all the predictions and the polling?
Well, I think a lot of us had been lulled into a false sense of confidence by the opinion polls. You know, there's not one opinion poll over the last 3 years that showed the government being re-elected. And whilst I didn't make a hard and fast prediction, I certainly didn't anticipate it. I thought the polls would be proven correct, but I always did say that you can never say never in politics, and there's always a chance of a surprise result, and I'm glad I didn't go out on a limb and say Labor would definitely win. There's a few of my colleagues have done that and they're paying for it now. But look, I mean, you just have to look back and say that Scott Morrison was very focused, very disciplined with Josh Frydenberg. It was brand ScoMo, not brand Liberal Party. And the voters liked him as Prime Minister. I thought he was a safe, sensible, reassuring, middle of the road kind of Prime Minister. So he wasn't threatening them in any way. He didn't have a big agenda. And that enabled them to also focus very heavily on Labor. And there's no doubt that Bill Shorten was a drag on Labor's vote. He was an unpopular leader. And, you know, the people I'd spoken to in the Labor Party just said to me, it goes back to him essentially helping to depose two of his predecessors, Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. The fact that he was a union guy also didn't test well in focus groups. And he didn't have a great presentation. You know, I followed him a couple of times on the campaign trail, interviewed him, and I didn't think he was all that polished and all that sharp. He seemed to me often to be slumming it when he was out there on the campaign trail. And I saw him give a few press conferences, and I just thought he's not as sharp. He's a bit arrogant here. And there's also the attack. So there's huge attacks on Labor. The tax agenda was deadly for Labor. Not only negative gearing, franking credits, capital gains tax, all these kind of things. And Labor didn't pivot. Labor didn't change. Coalition insiders told me they thought that Labor might change their franking credits policy. They might moderate it at the start of the campaign, pull it back a bit, but they didn't do that. And of course, there was this campaign about a death tax. Now, the death tax was something that was just totally invented, okay? I mean, there's no basis to suggest that Labor had a death tax, but it was a successfully prosecuted message, and that resonated. And I can tell you, this is going to be broadcast, I'll enjoy this, but my mother and my mother-in-law rang me during their campaign and said, is Labor proposing a death tax? Why are they doing that? Can you tell me about this? And I had to set them straight saying, there's no death tax. The other thing is that Labor's changes to franking credits was successfully recast as a retirees tax. And someone who'd been in a Labor focus group at the start of the campaign told me that Labor's franking credits was being regurgitated to them as a retirees tax. So when people in focus groups are using your opponent's language to describe your policies, you've got a big problem, and Labor didn't respond to that. So look, essentially, I think Bill Shorten was a bit of a low-energy, uninspirational figure. Morrison was safe and reassuring, sensible, middle-road guy, forgot about all the Liberal Party baggage, focused the campaign on him, and Labor just had, you know, what would probably now be regarded, using a term from British politics, the longest suicide note in political history. And all those things came to pass in the end. And the final comment I'd make, Michael, is that I think the defeat is much bigger for Labor than they think. It's not just that they've missed out by a few seats and the government has a small majority. 7 of the 10 most marginal seats in the country now, on margins of 1.5 or less, are held by Labor. So Labor will have to defend 7 seats very strongly, and then hope to win about 10 more from the government to be successful. That's going to be very, very tough for them. And the big swings against Labor in their held seats, Western Sydney, Queensland, Western Australia, Northern Tasmania, working class and middle class voters, that is very worrying for the Labor Party, and they're going to have to do some significant regrouping to win those voters back.
Thank you for that. So Mr. Morrison emerged from that win, from that campaign, as the victor, and now begins, in a sense, his approach to the world, because I think for the first 9 months, you know, he was seen as, he probably saw himself as an interim leader. Anyway, he was distracted by domestic issues. The world certainly saw him as an interim leader, as we saw when Angela Merkel had to flick through the headshots to remind herself who was Prime Minister these days. But now he's won election on his own terms. In fact, as we speak, he's in London. He was just meeting with Her Majesty, to go back to the Menzies example, gave her a book about Winx, which she liked. My sense is that his foreign, in terms of his foreign policy, I imagine it will be a little bit like his domestic policy. It will be pragmatic. It will be straightforward. You can imagine him being focused on interests. It's hard to see him being interested in Rudd-like sort of schemes, perhaps much as Menzies was sceptical of grand schemes and multilateralism. You can imagine perhaps Morrison might see himself as someone like Howard, perhaps like Menzies, focusing on bilateral relationships, being very focused on interests, and above all, being pragmatic. So what do you agree with that? Does that sort of feel like where a Morrison foreign policy will look like? And what are there any lessons that he should learn from his predecessor? Any traps to avoid?
Yeah, look, I agree with that, Michael. I think, as I said at the outset, that Morrison had said about Menzies that whatever Menzies believed in then is what we believe in now. That's probably going to be, in many ways, his guide for foreign policy. I think it's going to be very much personal-led. He's going to try to develop those relationships with world leaders. He's already been through the so-called summit season at the second half of the year, last year, and he's going to focus on these relationships. Clearly, the relationship with Donald Trump is fraught with danger and unpredictability and uncertainty, and that's never good in foreign policy. But Malcolm Turnbull, to his credit, handled Donald Trump very, very well and won a number of concessions on tariffs and things like that that he probably hasn't got enough credit for. So his skills are going to be tested there in dealing with Donald Trump, and I think he'll be very careful in that regard. He will, I think, focus on that personal relationship with leaders in the Asia-Pacific probably more than his predecessor. We've just seen him in the Solomon Islands. And the other big challenge is going to be China. Of course, trying to, recognise that China is it's in Australia's strategic interests to have a close and cooperative relationship with China while also standing up for our own interests and our own values. And this is a very, very difficult balancing act. And so that's partly the reason why he's been in the Solomons. So dealing with these things on the world stage are going to be challenging. I don't anticipate any huge departures in foreign policy, which is still largely bipartisan. But Australia's got to be careful. And, you know, I made a point in my column yesterday in The Australian that having these three Chinese warships steam into Sydney Harbour unannounced on the eve of the Tiananmen Square anniversary was a mistake. And that should have been announced publicly. In fact, I think they should have been told to come next week or be here last week. And so this is a relationship that requires some deft handling. But he's a good politician, and I think he'll be able to handle it fine.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's take some questions, perhaps principally on Mr. Menzies, but if we want to think about Mr. Morrison as well, we can. If you could wait for the microphone, if you could tell us your name and any affiliation at the beginning and then ask a brief question. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Bill Apsher. I'm a PhD student at UNSW. I enjoyed your book a lot, Troy. Thank you very much. I agree with you that it is quite extraordinary how little biography Menzies has attracted, considering his role. You talked about successes and failures. I must have missed, I've read the comments in your book, but today I don't think we've talked about Suez. Would you like to talk about that in particular? The comment I believe you made in the book that Menzies was not aware of the British and French military action, planned military action. Could you comment on that and the extent to which that was a failing on Menzies' part and he could arguably be seen as duped through it, or whether he really was aware?
Sure. This is a long, complex story, so I'll try to be brief. Most of you wouldn't have knowledge of the 1956 Suez crisis, where the Egyptian president nationalised the canal, which had been run by an Anglo-French company. Menzies was in London at the time and participated in a number of crisis meetings, and then was encouraged to lead a smaller committee representing different nations to negotiate directly with Nasser and try to get him to reverse his nationalisation of the canal and make it a shared international waterway. This is a mistake on Menzies' part. It was always going to be high risk, but the reward would be great if he pulled it off. The odds were always stacked against him, but he didn't handle himself well in the negotiations. And I found a couple of diary notes that Menzies had kept about these visits to Egypt, which I don't think had been disclosed before. So some of the Menzies papers have been added in later years by the Menzies family. But anyway, he basically threatened Nasser, saying to him that, you know, if you don't reverse this nationalisation, don't think that the idea of the use of force to take it back could be ruled out. And that got Nasser's back up very, very strongly, and he basically told Menzies to go home. And he maybe in a little bit stronger terms than that. He maintained the nationalisation. Well, meanwhile, Israel decided to invade the canal zone, which Menzies wasn't aware of, and that was then followed up by British and French forces, and he didn't have any knowledge of that either. So even though he had flagged force, he didn't know that this was happening, perhaps other than a rumour, and he certainly wasn't tipped off in advance. But then the big thing that happened was the United States, who had encouraged Menzies to lead this delegation, told the Israeli, French and British forces to withdraw. And the United Nations had condemned the action. And they eventually did withdraw, and Nasser had a huge victory. And so Menzies was humiliated by that incident on the world stage, and particularly with Eisenhower. It's often forgotten that this happened in September 1956. Eisenhower was going for re-election in early November. He didn't want a global conflict involving world powers while he's going for re-election. So he took a very dim view, and he didn't have a great relationship with Menzies. So he was mistaken in that endeavour on the world stage. But Menzies never regretted it. He thought that the Americans were wrong. He thought that they would have won that war if it continued on, and they would have seized back control of the canal. And he maintained this view for the rest of his life, that he had been dutted, essentially, by the Americans.
My name is Jim Deminks. I'm a political observer. And I particularly enjoyed your comment in yesterday's Australian, the day that China broke Bob Hawke's heart. It was very well researched and quite moving. I wanted to just take issue with you, Troy, if I may be so presumptuous, on this question of the wealth tax. Was it your mother and your mother-in-law?
It was.
Yes, I thought they might have been a bit more, with respect, more percipient than you. Because had there been a narrow result in favour of Labor and they governed only with the support of the Greens and the unions, I would see there would have been very little time wasted before we would have had a death tax, a wealth tax visited upon us. You don't agree with that?
I don't, no. I just don't think there was never any public plan for Labor to bring in a death tax. Some rogue union leaders and other MPs may have talked about it in the past. But, you know, having talked to all the Labor people, Bill Shorten, Jim Chalmers, Chris Bowen, during and after the campaign, there was never any plan for that whatsoever. And, in fact, they had said as such during the campaign. So I just don't know how that campaign got legs. It was run largely on social media, particularly on Facebook, which is, I described it during the campaign as the Wild West of the election campaign, where anything goes and there's no law there stopping anyone from saying anything they want. I just disagree with you. I just don't think there was any Labor plan, or secret or public, for a death tax.
Yes.
But let me say thank you for your nice comments on my article yesterday.
Hello. William Maley from the ANU.
Hi, Bill.
Hi. One of the things, on which I'd like your reflection, is whether you've had a look at the essay that Menzies published in 1917 called The Rule of Law During the War. This is historically interesting because he had a notably internationalist approach to international law in that particular essay. And I think it was actually the League of Nations experience and the spectacular failure of the League with the outbreak of the Second World War that entrenched in him a degree of scepticism about international organisation as a way of giving effect to these kinds of aspirations. It's a very interesting essay.
Yeah, look, I do remember reading it probably a couple of years ago. It's just not front of mind. But essentially, your point is right. Menzies, although he didn't serve in the First World War, he supported it, and he supported conscription, and he backed strongly Billy Hughes in his two campaigns to get support for conscription. But you're right, he had a natural aversion to grand schemes such as the United Nations. He was never comfortable there, didn't go very often. And there's a famous incident, I think it's in 1961, I think, where the Indian Prime Minister, Nehru, had suggested that the Soviet Union and the United States get together to talk about arms control. And Menzies moved an amendment to that at the United Nations, saying that they should be joined by the British and the French. And Nehru and others said, oh, this was just an attempt to reconvene the big powers from World War II, and you're living in another age, Menzies. And he was quite savage in his attack on the floor of the United Nations against Menzies. And Menzies in these interviews said that he hated the sight of Nehru and made him feel sick whenever he saw him, had absolute contempt for him. So Menzies wasn't a big fan of the United Nations or its predecessor, the League of Nations, and he just didn't think, quite frankly, that these, what he would call as somewhat underdeveloped nations, should have a big seat at the table where alongside the United States and Great Britain, for example. He was, as he said to the end, a Commonwealth man.
My name's Edward Nind, independent researcher. I'm not affiliated with any organisation. Because Australia manoeuvred very well between great powers as a middle power, and then what kind of advice would you have for smaller nations in Asia who are stuck between those great power politics, and how they should balance between, you know, Australia balance between one, on the other hand, the biggest trade partner with China, and also they manage quite well with US relationship. So any advice for them?
Well, this is probably a question better directed at Michael, being the foreign policy expert. But I'll make a brief comment. Look, I think you've got to speak to your own country's values, and that's what's always guided Australian foreign policy. There is nevertheless a strong sense of insurance being taken out with the alliance with the United States, and Menzies in fact used that term himself. And that was what A.J. Forbes, his army minister, said to me was really the reason Australia went to Vietnam, was to show the flag, so to speak, is another term that Menzies used, alongside the United States. So there's a sense of security that comes with that. But Australian leaders, you know, for generations now, have been pragmatic in recognising Australia's economic interests are increasingly tied with China, but our security interests are always linked to the United States. So you've got to steer your own path and find a middle way, I guess. But, you know, this is a very challenging topic, and there's a number of countries in the Asia Pacific that are reconsidering their historical allegiances, and some are more welcoming of a greater China role in the Pacific than others. And it's up to those individual nations, I guess, to decide what is in their own interests. And your foreign policy has to be backed, not by necessarily picking winners, but I think by your own values and understanding what your own people want. And any politician in Australia who tries to junk the relationship with the United States, which stands regardless of which president or party is in power, would do so at their peril. This is a principal bedrock of our international relations. But that does not mean, as the Lowy Institute poll has showed over years, that Australians are hostile to China or having a good and cooperative relationship with that country as well.
I'm not going to hijack Troy's event. I did give a speech on this topic in October here at the Institute, so I can give you a link to that speech afterwards, which has some ideas. I'll also give a shout-out to the Lowy Institute poll, which is out later this month, this time to be authored by Natasha Kassam. And that has some very interesting new findings on the China relationship in particular. But I won't say anything else because Alex is staring at me darkly. But let me ask a follow-up question on that. We've talked a lot about Menzies on this gentleman's question. We've talked a lot about Menzies' view of great and powerful friends. What did he think of China?
He didn't like China. Let's just put that out there. He, in these interviews,
like communist China, or he didn't like the civilization of China.
Well, he didn't like the Chinese government or the philosophy of communism. And I can say to you quite clearly, because it was sort of startling to me to hear him in these interviews in 1971, 72, 73, saying that he opposed diplomatic recognition of China, which of course was initiated by the Whitlam government in 1972. I thought that was a terrible mistake. He uses a phrase, which I think is in the book, something like, Australia is getting into bed with its enemies. And so he just could not conceive the world as it was changing, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s.
Did you mind on that when the Nixon government recognised the PRC?
No, he didn't. He did not change his view on that at all. He had a very strident anti-communist view, was not pragmatic in that sense at all. And it's important to note, too, a brief comment about the White Australia policy. So Menzies supported the White Australia policy, defended it, prosecuted it his entire life. And even when some in his party were trying to get the Liberal Party and the National Party to move away from such a strong White Australia policy, dilute it a little bit, he would not have a bar of it. So there's a great story about Hubert Opperman, who was the former Olympic cyclist. He was Menzies' immigration minister. Opperman had went a number of times to the cabinet with a submission to allow skilled migrants from Asia to come in work in Australia. Menzies didn't want to have it at all, but within months of Menzies resigning as Prime Minister in January 1966, the Holt government moved quickly in this one of many areas of policy ossification and changed course dramatically. We see Menzies out of time, I think, increasingly by the mid-1960s. He was out of time also on the Aboriginal referendum. Of course, there was a proposal to have a referendum in two parts, which would remove discriminatory provisions in the Constitution and also count Aboriginal Australians in the census. Menzies would only support a referendum to count Aboriginal people in the census, and that was a cabinet decision. But when the Holt government came in, again, they quickly overturned that decision and had a dual referendum, which, of course, is Australia's most successful referendum. So on these issues of race, Menzies doesn't look all that great with a contemporary lens.
So there are limits to the nostrum that what Menzies believed then is what we believe now.
That's right.
Let me ask you, you mentioned Whitlam, and One would assume that Menzies looked very dimly on a lot of the innovations that the Whitlam government brought in, but I remember reading in Whitlam biographies that Whitlam and Menzies actually had a nice personal relationship, and he was quite a gracious, I think Menzies was quite a gracious correspondent with Whitlam, wasn't he? Or is that...
Briefly, yes, okay. Yes. So this is a great story. Menzies had known Whitlam's father and father-in-law. So Fred Whitlam was a Solicitor General, and his father-in-law, Judge Bill Dovey, was on the bench. And Bill Dovey was a Liberal. And Bill Dovey had written a letter to Menzies in 1939 congratulating him on becoming Prime Minister. Menzies had wrote a very flattering letter back to Bill Dovey, and Bill Dovey had that letter framed and on his office wall for the rest of his life, is how much he admired Menzies. So Menzies knew Whitlam. And when Whitlam was elected to Parliament, I think 52, 53, he invited Whitlam into his office because he'd seen Whitlam give some very strident, forceful, firebrand-style speeches in the Parliament, and Menzies thought this was not on. And so he decided to invite Whitlam into his office and give him some free advice about how to tone down his parliamentary appearances. And these are in the interviews that Menzies gave at the end of his life. He said that Whitlam didn't take that advice at all, and so he basically wrote Whitlam off. But then years later, when Whitlam became Prime Minister, he wrote a very glowing letter to Menzies, which I produce in full in the book, because Whitlam lays it on with a trowel to Menzies. He says, "You are the great statesman in Australian history. You are the model, ideal Prime Minister. And, you know, my wife, Margaret, and I give you and Dame Patty, you know, our warmest affections and regards," and it goes on and on and on. Menzies was quite chuffed by this. But over time, he didn't like the Whitlam government at all. Didn't like the China thing. Didn't like a lot of the civil liberties focus of the Menzies of the Whitlam government. And by the end, he was an advocate for the dismissal. And he gave a lot of private support to John Kerr during and after the dismissal. And some of the things that Menzies wrote, which were not published, comparing Labor Party rallies to Nuremberg rallies and comparing Whitlam to Adolf Hitler, are quite beyond the pale, but they're in the book if you want to read them.
Well, Troy's ended with a reference to the book, which is great. And as I mentioned, we have a terrific bookseller here. Thank you for being here, who's happy to deliver you a book. Let me say that Troy mentioned earlier that Facebook is like the Wild West, where there are no rules that apply. But the Lowy Institute is not like the Wild West. There are rules that apply, and one rule is that we finish on time. So although a couple of other people wanted questions, I'm going to draw it to a close. I think in that final story, you got a sense, again, of where I began on Troy, that why he's such an unusual and effective member of the Fourth Estate, because he's got so much historical knowledge of so many aspects of Australian political culture and political history, and I think it enlivens his columns, and it certainly enlivens his books. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here, and please join me in thanking Troy.